Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
The Jericho Network on Westwood One.
How's everybody doing? Oh, the wild people over here. All right, it's the 40th anniversary of Kiss Alive. And guess who's back on Talk is Jericho to discuss all things Kiss? Paul Stanley is here. The Star Child joins us again to discuss the greatest, one of the greatest live records of all time, the 40-year anniversary. September 10th, 1975, Kiss Alive came out, and it changed Kiss's entire fortune, changed the way things in the music business worked, might have even created disco. Yeah, that's right. We talk all about that. Plus, we talk about the Kiss Cruise, which Fozzy is joining the Kiss Navy in November. You're going to get an inside peek at Paul Stanley's man cave, because that's where we recorded this interview. Hard to believe Kiss Alive is turning 40, and how great the record still stands today. 40 years and going strong. It is a testament. Classic Kiss, possibly my favorite album of all time. I'll discuss that more a little bit later.
I tell you, I got this feeling tonight's gonna be one of those hot nights. Yeah! We're gonna get this place hotter than hell!
Talk is Jericho, baby! Talk is Jericho! Talk is Jericho, mama! Talk is me!
Alright, welcome to Talk is Jericho!
I'm the king of the podcast world! And you're my podcast queen
or king. A little Kiss influence jingle, the king of the podcast world, that is me, and the king of rock and roll, Kiss, and Paul Stanley returning to Talk is Jericho to celebrate the 40th anniversary of the Kiss Alive record. Now, I'll tell you what, the Kiss Alive record, I remember in 93 in Mexico, I made a list of my top 100 records of all time, and Kiss Alive was at the top of that list. Now, you guys know I came into Kiss kind of late, if you've been listening to this podcast, when I talked to Paul last, when I talked to Gene Simmons. 80s Kiss was my jam. And I first got into Kiss when the Animalized record came out, and then kind of worked my way backwards. So Alive 2, I was really, really into it when I kind of discovered it. And I love the cover, and that's why I got into that first. And then I went and I said, well, I like Kiss Alive 2 so much, but I didn't really like the studio songs. I thought, well, they could have done maybe another side of live songs. And then I kind of traced myself back and then went and bought Kiss Alive. I didn't really like the cover of Kiss Alive as much as I liked the cover of Kiss Alive 2, but I thought I'd give it a try. And man, it blew my mind. Because keep in mind, I'd never heard any of those songs before because I came into Kiss in 1984. So I had to work my way backwards. I might have heard, I don't even think I'd heard Deuce or Strutter or any of those songs, probably Rock and Roll Night. Black Diamond, maybe Black Diamond, because they played it on the Animalized tour. So I kind of knew those type of songs, but I was really, really into it. especially the songs that I had no idea, Watching You, She, 100,000 Years, with the amazing super long stage rap and the drum solo, and just really, it really blew my mind. And I think my favorite was the intro to Cold Gin.
There's got to be some people out there that like to drink tequila. All right. I was talking to somebody backstage before, and they were telling me there's a lot of you people there that like to drink vodka and orange juice. Yeah. I'll tell you something. When you're down in the dumps and you need something to bring you up, there's only one thing that's gonna do it the way you want it. What's that? I can't hear you. Cold gin.
Paul talks about how hot it is outside. You know, and if it's so hot outside, the only thing that can cool you off is a shot of tequila, right? Don't worry about a taste of alcohol can cool you off. Don't worry about iced tea or ice water or a soda. You got to go straight for the hard stuff. And don't even worry about beer. You got to go straight for the hard liquor. And I love the way when he's doing this rap, he talks about vodka and orange juice. He's got that really thick New York accent. You like the vodka and orange juice. And I thought that was so cool. And this is when I was, how old was I? 14? Maybe 15, but I think it was 14. I thought that was so cool. I was like, when I'm old enough to drink, someday when I grow up and I can drink, I'm going to drink vodka and orange juices, because Paul Stanley made them sound so cool. Vodka and orange juice. So lo and behold, I grew up and started drinking vodka and orange juices. And I used to work at this bar in Calgary. I was a bouncer. It was called Malarkey's. Shout out to all the former Malarkey's employees. And Lance Storm worked there as well. So I was one of the worst bouncers of all time. I used to just hang out by the DJ booth and look at the girls, look at the chicks. Whenever a fight broke out, by the time I got there, it was usually done. I wasn't there to fight. It was there just to listen to music and look at girls, right? And it was a good job to have because I was wrestling at the time. So if I needed a weekend off to wrestle, I could get it. Or when I got the very rare Japanese tour back in those days, I could have a week off to go, or 3 weeks or whatever it was. So everybody in the bar knew me, though. They used to like me. They called me Biff, was my nickname. Everyone had nicknames. My nickname was Biff because I had super long dyed blonde hair. So there you go, Biff Jericho. And they knew that my favorite drink was a vodka and orange juice, which I called a Paul Stanley because of his intro in Kiss Alive. I'll have a Paul Stanley, please, which would mean a vodka and orange juice. So whenever I walked in the bar, hey, Chris, you want a Paul Stanley? Yes, I would love a Paul Stanley. And then a rum and coke was a Gene Simmons. Okay. Then I think a gin and tonic was an Ace Frehley. And then I don't think there was a Peter Criss, because I said no one cares about Peter Criss anyways. Which is totally not true. But so it was a Paul Stanley, a Gene Simmons, and an Ace Frehley. But the Paul Stanleys was what I was known for drinking. And oh God, I think a lot, I had all like these like ditches in my teeth up near the gums. I had to get, what do you call them? You would have to put like plates over top of them. I think it's because I drank so much orange juice. So anyways, I would always drink the Paul Stanley. So to this day, if you ever meet anybody from Calgary who was in the bar scene in the early 90s and ask them for a Paul Stanley, they'll know exactly what it was. A vodka and orange juice. So meanwhile, I don't drink Paul Stanley's anymore because the orange juice is very sugary. Like I said, messed up my teeth. Had to put those plates on there. Like, it was right near the gums. It would make like all these kind of divots in there. So you'd have to get these like kind of plates kind of fused on there. And I stopped drinking the orange juice. And now, of course, I switched to Yeah Boys. So Yeah Boy is vodka on the rocks. and a Paul Stanley is vodka and orange juice. So loved that record, the Kiss Alive record. And I talked to Paul about this upcoming as how the tempos of the songs were increased. Like, there was so much more energy on Kiss Alive than there was on the previous three records. Dressed to Kill, Hotter Than Hell, and the first Kiss record. So the tempos are more energetic. The feeling, the vibe is more energetic. It just really showcased Kiss as this amazing kind of fiery, electric act. And I know one of the big things about Kiss Alive, well, it's not live. It was kind of recreated in the studio. I'll tell you what, like, I think Paul talks about this later on. Most live records are like that. To get a live record, it's either going to have a lot of clams on it, it's going to sound bad, or it's going to have, you know, a lot of issues as far as, the dynamics of it and all that sort of thing, the sound of it. So you want this to be a perfect souvenir of the live show, and you want it to be right. You want it to be good. You want it to be perfect. And even though Kiss Alive is not perfect, there is mistakes in there. There's a mistake in Parasite at the beginning, but it's real. And it's a real representation of what Kiss was like. And Paul kind of discusses all of the reasons why there was some studio re-recording there, and also the reasons why it was such a huge hit. You know, it kind of changed Kiss's fortune. And kind of made them it was the first step to them really taking over the world and becoming the biggest band of the 70s, or one of the biggest bands of the 70s. So I'm excited to have Paul Stanley back. I went to his house in Los Angeles. He was very gracious in talking to me about Kiss Alive 40th anniversary. It's an idea that I came up with, I don't know, maybe 6 months ago. And I guess about a month ago, I went to Paul's place. And here we are to talk the 40th anniversary of Kiss Alive. It's a Kiss fan's dream. It's also a great representation of the 70s, the kind of the early to mid 70s, when the live record was a big deal. You know, Cheap Trick at Budokan and Peter Frampton Comes Alive, and so many classic live records were released at that point in time. And most of them, the songs were better live than they were in the studio. You think of I Want You to Want Me and Rock and Roll All Night, and you think of I Want You to Show Me the Way. So live albums not as important anymore, but it was a different time back in the 70s. And we discuss all things 1975, all things Kiss. Paul Stanley returns to Talk Is Jericho.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Kiss loves you!
All right, always a little bit scary when I'm setting this stuff up and it doesn't work, especially when I'm actually at Paul Stanley's house or like waiting around for this stupid Zoom recorder to go, but it works. Everybody's excited and happy. So first of all, what a cool place you have here. And it's almost your painting studios down
yeah,
here.
Yeah, this is where I do my painting, and this is a listening room. I always, I think most people have forgotten what music's supposed to sound like on a good system, because we've miniaturized everything, or you put little speakers in the walls. And I was in the studio one day with Evan, and we were listening to something, and I went, my God, we've really forgotten what it's supposed to sound like. And I was listening to an album, and it just sounded completely different than it did at home. So I said, let's build a room where we can really listen to music the way we once did. So I pulled out my old JBL. These are L100s. There's also a set of 4311s. The studio that was arguably the first place I ever worked was Electric Lady Studios, Hendrix's Studios, and the monitors were these JBLs. So I got them out, had them reconed, brought back to specs, got some Macintosh amps and gear, and to sit in here and listen to music is just awesome.
Are these actually the studios from Electric Lady, or the speakers from Electric Lady?
I know it sounded like that.
Yeah.
These are ones I bought at the same time when I first heard them, and I went, wow, this is incredible. And speakers are really a matter of taste. Sometimes people get intimidated into buying something because it's expensive or somebody is pushing them in that direction. Really, whatever sounds good to you is what's good. And some people will say, oh, JBL speakers color the music. That's a term. You know, some people talk about transparency of music and that you're not supposed to hear the speaker. But I'm a huge fan of JBL speakers.
What are you listening to down here?
It's hard to get away from Zeppelin. You know, that just always sounds amazing. Steely Dan sounds great.
Really?
Yeah, Steely Dan, you know, on a great system, when you really hear what's going on, that's what a lot of people miss, I think, in listening to music, is you get a sense of a sound, but you don't understand what's making that sound. And when all of a sudden you can go, oh, wait a minute, that's a clarinet in the background. Wait a minute, that's a tambourine. That's, you know, another guitar part. That's what makes music listening, at least for me, so exciting, is to be able to decipher and pick out, when I listen to Motown things, and go, wait a minute, that's a piano in the background. So that, to me, is why listening is so enjoyable, but it also takes some decent equipment.
Well, and if you have that, though, like you said, you can really tell the difference between an LP, which begat the CD, which begat the MP3. You know, you buy something off of iTunes, it's just the way of the world now, but there's nothing that beats that. You know, like you said, you can hear the oh, there's a horn over here, there's a little piano. I mean, even like this, for example, some of your stuff, Shout Out Loud, there's that little piano trill that you don't really notice unless you notice it, you know?
And that's really the beauty of great production, is that you hear things, but you sometimes, it's like a recipe. When you put a bunch of ingredients together, you come up with something, but you can't really tell what it actually is, because it's a combination of things. So, people would listen to Detroit Rock City or Shout It Out Loud, and the chords on Detroit Rock City are all doubled with a grand piano. So to have a decent set of speakers, and I'm not saying, you know, 10-foot-tall speakers with 30 speakers in each, just a decent set of speakers makes all the difference in the world, and a decent amplifier to be able to really enjoy music. You'll never get it from in-wall speakers. You'll never get it from those little mini speakers in a subwoofer. That's great stuff. It's convenient, but it'll never give you the joy that you can get from music, that I got from music when I was younger, you know, when I was in the studio. So to recreate that here, I mean, this room is pretty timeless in the sense, like Vegas, there's no clocks in this room, all the windows are blacked out, and it's just a room I can come to anytime, bring a friend or two in here, and I fall asleep in here sometimes listening to music.
It's almost got the vibe of almost like a teenager's bedroom too.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to create a hideaway. And this really, I mean, when you walk into this house, which is where I paint, you don't even know this room is here, because there's a wall and a curtain on the wall. And then you open up the curtain and you're in, you know, the Bat Cave.
Secret catacombs. Yeah, the Bat Cave, right?
Yeah.
Do you still get joy out of listening to music?
Totally.
That never goes away, right?
No. Music is the beauty of music is the emotion that it elicits, without necessarily having to understand why you're reacting to it in a certain way. I get that listening to certain opera, get that listening to certain rock and roll. It's just when your eyes well up or the hair on your arm stands up, it's an emotional reaction, and it's like great art. You know, if it connects with you, it gets a response. So music to me, I still just have an incredible joy listening to music.
There's a real time travel element to it as well. Like, you can listen to a record that maybe came out the year you graduated from high school, or maybe it was the first time you drove a car, or whatever it may be. Sometimes I hear certain songs and it will take you back to that moment.
Yeah, and that's magical. You'll hear a song. I'll hear a song and I'll smell something that I remember, you know, gee, I was building a model car when I first heard that song, you know, or gee, I was eating, you know, the sandwich. So, or I was with somebody. So, music is very much, it's a musical snapshot of your life. It's a photo album. Mm-hmm. And songs very much take you back to certain times. At least they do for me. I mean, I can remember, you know, to the instant when I first heard a song and what I was doing, where I was, who I was with. That's pretty powerful.
Does it work that way for your own material as well?
Yeah. Some of it is better left forgotten. but yeah, you know, a lot of what I've written has a time stamp on it because I do remember writing it or the people I was with or relationships I was in. So yeah, music, for me, I'm very connected to a lot of my songs.
Can you remember, like, if I said, like, Love Gun, like, do you remember where you wrote that?
Sure. Love Gun, I had heard a band in Queens in a park called Cunningham Park, which was on Union Turnpike. And I guess during the summer, they let bands, local bands, get up and play. And I remember these guys getting up, and they were just a little bit older than I was. And clearly they wanted to be Led Zeppelin. And this was late 60s. And they did a version of The Hunter, which is basically...
Is that Mott the Hoople?
No, The Hunter is actually... it was an R&B song that everybody's covered. Well, Zeppelin did it. It's on... How many more times? They call me the Hunter. Mm. They call me the Hunter. That's my name. Ain't no need to run. Ain't no need to... Because I've got you in the sights of my gun. Well, it's really got you in the sights of my love gun. So I remember seeing this band doing this kind of like rip-off Led Zeppelin version of the Hunter. And... that always stuck with me. And I was on an airplane one day, and Love Gun came to me, basically in its entirety.
Just like as if, like all at once?
All at once. Chords, the whole thing. And by the time we landed, I had the song. I just had to go play it. You know, whole thing pretty much wrote itself.
See, that's hard, though. Like now, if you had that... We get on our phones, you get on your voice message or whatever, you
sure.
Sing the riff. Nah, nah,
yeah.
Nah, 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 nah.
Yeah.
How do you remember that, though, when you're on a plane?
It's much more difficult.
Yeah.
Much more difficult. I'd say that probably 90% of all the songs I've written were written on a cassette recorder, $39 cassette recorder. I would run into, you know, a CVS or a Rexall, whatever was around, and buy a little pocket cassette player, and I usually had one of those in my car, and it would be on the seat next to me, and I would sing whatever came to mind. Then when voicemail started, I would call myself up and sing.
Yeah.
So it's much more difficult, particularly for somebody who doesn't have any schooling, because you're really left to your limitations.
You're talking about musical schooling.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, you have to, you can't write it down. You have to memorize it or put it into some form where you can hear it again.
Mm-hmm.
So, but Love Gun very much was, very, very quick and very easy. And I knew all the parts. And then I went in the studio and basically, brought in a drummer from another band, recorded the song, played the bass, played all the guitars, did the vocals and background vocals. I believe that's on one of the big compilations that we've done, the demo of Love Gun, which is virtually identical to what
the same,
we did.
Right.
Yeah, all we did was copy it.
Because sometimes you guys did demos that change. I know God of Thunder...
Mm-hmm.
Because I just recently heard the demo for that. It's got almost got more of like a disco.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. some songs changed, although most of them didn't. Most of them stayed very much in their original form. Detroit changed somewhat, but that was really, I think, around, that was kind of like Ezrin's era. And when Bob was involved, he usually had some pretty brilliant ideas in terms of changing things or getting the best out of them. And that was the case with Detroit, and that was the case with God of Thunder.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
People!
Well, let's talk about, you know, one of the reasons why I wanted to get together with you is this, the 40th anniversary of Kiss Alive, which probably blows your mind to think 40 years, like, oh my gosh, still possibly could be Kiss's best record, at least as far as a perfect example of what the band is. Mm. You know, I mean, does it feel like 40 years for you?
No. I grapple almost daily with the idea of getting older because it's not what I thought it would be. And in some ways, the truth is, yes, time goes by incredibly quickly. And then the other truth is that you don't really change much. If you take care of yourself and if you're living a good life, I don't quite know where the 40 years went. Mm-hmm. It's mind-boggling because you also have to remember that when we recorded Kiss Alive, I wasn't 6 years old. You know, I was 22, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty mind-boggling to think that that album is 40 years old. It's also mind-boggling, you know, to me to think that the first Zeppelin album is, you know, what is that now in terms of age?
Yeah, 45 years, 47 years. I mean, 68, I think it was.
Yeah.
So 47 years.
Yeah. And that was so life-changing for me, that first Zeppelin album. You know, there are certain markers in my life which very much defined and gave me a template for what I wanted to do. And certainly the first time I heard Good Times, Bad Times on the radio, my jaw dropped. It was unlike anything else. But again, like great art affects you in a way that only great art can. So to hear Good Times, Bad Times, or the first time I heard I Want to Hold Your Hand, mm-hmm. Those moments are, you know, they're life-changing.
Well, sure, absolutely. But once again, to a whole different generation, Kiss Alive is life-changing. What was the state of the band, though, at this point in time when you guys were about to record Kiss Alive?
When we did Kiss Alive, we were, you know, we were in a tough spot because we had pretty much worn out our welcome as an opening act. Bands wouldn't have us play with them anymore.
Because you're blowing them away.
Because we were blowing them off the stage, and literally and figuratively. this was a time where the rules hadn't really been written yet. So an opening act could come out and hang a Kiss sign. Well, you can't do that nowadays because it's not allowed.
Like when you would do a show, it's with full production.
Yeah, we did everything.
And you wouldn't have to ask the headliner's permission.
No,
you would just do it.
Well, because they didn't know what to expect.
Oh, yeah.
And because that kind of show didn't exist. So, yeah, you're the opening act, you know, and the fact that we had, you know, an arsonist who was our pyrotechnician, you know, or we had guys hanging signs up and stuff, it didn't register with any of these other bands or their managers until after the fact. So we weren't told initially what we couldn't do because it wasn't expected. But over time, we were finally told, you know, you're not welcome back. You know, we don't want to play with you anymore.
Tell me some bands that kicked you off the tour when they saw what you were doing.
The first one that would come to mind probably is Black Oak Arkansas, who were quite big at the time.
Mm-hmm. Jackie Blue and
that's the Ozark Mountain Daredevils.
Oh, sorry,
that's okay.
Close.
It's okay. There's very close.
Ozark in there.
One of those long names. Black Oak Arkansas had a singer named Jim Dandy.
Ah, yes.
And
like the original David Lee Roth type vibe.
You got it.
Yeah.
You got it. And we just went out there. You know, our philosophy was always, we respect you, we like you, but we're going to go out and do what needs to be done. We went out to kill.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was who we were and what we believed in. So Black Oak threw us off the tour very quickly. I don't remember being thrown off many tours as much as I remember not being invited back.
So, like, for example, with Black Oak, did they say, listen, you guys got to tone down your show or you're off the tour?
I think one day it was, if you set the curtains on fire again, you're out of here, or something like that. So it wasn't a lasting relationship. Hey, I understand it in some ways. You know, it's got to be overwhelming to have a bunch of young guys come out there committed tenfold as much as you are. You know, I think headliners had become complacent and had found a place of kind of feeling kind of like the tail wagging the dog. All of a sudden, the band on stage thought they were doing you a favor by being there. And we didn't live by that philosophy. We were audience members. We were rock fans who wanted to be the band we never saw. Well, that's pretty hard to compete with. Especially, you know, I mean, it's a wake-up call that can take you off your game. So, you know, I can understand if you can't beat them, you don't fight them. You know?
Did you ever have any band that was like, hey, do whatever you guys want to do. We're cool with it.
No.
Okay.
No. You know, as time went on, interestingly, we always felt, once we were in a position to headline, do anything you want.
Mm.
Go out there and give it your best. I've always believed that if I can only beat you by tying one of your arms behind your back, then I don't deserve to be the champ. You know, I want at the end of the night for you to know why we're the headliner. Mm. And it's not going to be because we handicapped the other band. So I think our reputation has always been pretty strong for supporting the other bands and trying to show them in their best light.
Was there some bands that you took out with you that used pyro and stuff like in the 80s?
Not that many. I do remember in the early 80s having Motley Crue out with us. And, you know, this was pretty much in the beginning of the band. And, look, it was clear who they were influenced by, and it was clear that some of what they were doing was reminiscent, but so what? You know, they were, you know, I'm not a fan. I mean, without naming names, you know, there were a couple of groups where guys were going on stage before me and basically doing my raps, and that doesn't work. You know, that's like, you know, you don't, as a comedian, you don't steal jokes. You know, you don't take other people's craft. You don't, you know, it's one thing when you're off on your own, but hey, if I'm going to go out there and you've already basically done a bad impression of me, that's just not cool.
Right. That's not going to work. So you're talking about how you're blowing everybody off the stage.
Mm.
But then conversely, the records, not selling, right?
No. Correct. Our records weren't selling anywhere near the kind of response we were getting from an audience. By the mania and the kind of fans we were getting and how demonstrative and how into the band they were, you would think we would be doing much, much better. But we weren't. And somehow, something was getting lost in the translation. Almost like we used to play a game called telephone, where you have a line of people and somebody whispers something into the first person's ear and it gets whispered. By the time it gets to the last person, it doesn't resemble what
yes,
we said.
Exactly, yeah.
So it, in some ways it was is similar to that, because you had us going out there and doing something, the people loving it, and somewhere down the line it lost its impact. And where it lost its impact was in the recordings. The studio albums just weren't really a reflection of who we were. To this day, I still scratch my head about most of them. They just sonically didn't capture who this band is or was. So people would come to see the show. They'd love us. They'd love the song sounded great. They sounded bombastic. And then you'd get these albums, and they kind of sounded like, for better or worse, a garage band, which is okay, but we weren't a garage band. So maybe that's part of the charm today in people listening to those albums. But back then, I think that people were kind of dismayed when they got the album, said, this is the band I just saw?
Mm-hmm.
So Bill Acoin, who's so responsible for so much of what we were and what got us to where we are, Bill one day says, we're going to do a live album. Which you might as well said, we're going to record on the moon. I mean, it was like, we're going to do a live album, you know.
Because they weren't really very prevalent at the time.
No, and anything live at that point, most of the recordings that you ever heard live, whether they were classical concerts or whatever they were, you didn't even know they were live until a song ended and you heard some tepid applause. We set out to make a sonic souvenir of the show. We set out to make something that would replicate your experience at the show, which is virtually impossible. It's impossible to just take what goes down on tape and to have that be a reasonable facsimile. You know, not to burst anybody's bubble, but to immerse the listener in the crowd, you have to surround the listener with other audience members. To hear bombs that sound like cannons, you need cannons. Because when you try to record stage flash pots or anything like that, they cause the microphone to collapse. So it sounds like a cap gun. So what do? You replace those cap guns with cannons. What do? You add audience. And you add audience. What did we do? We added audience throughout, because people don't shut up during a song. So we wanted an accurate representation of who we are and who we were. And that didn't mean untouched, because untouched wouldn't have been an accurate representation. To paint that picture, you had to use paint.
Mm, right.
So did we embellish it? Hell yeah. And that's why Kiss Alive is considered arguably, if not the greatest live rock album, one of the top five.
I agree.
And that's because it captures the band and the experience.
When you're talking about, you mentioned Neil Bogart, and was there money coming in? Were you guys like in debt at this point in time? Were you financed by bills, credit cards, and all that sort of thing?
Yeah. Oh yeah. We were digging ourselves into deeper debt. It didn't matter because we were broke, you know. Debt, who cares? I had got no money, you know. I don't mind owing more. I have nothing, you know.
Yeah.
You owe more. Yeah. But you know, okay, if I make money, I'll pay you back. But right now, I'm not losing any sleep over it. But yeah, we weren't making, you know, I think I was getting $60 a week or something.
Wow.
Like that, and feeling damn proud and happy. I'm getting paid to do what I love. You know, I'm playing rock and roll music and I'm getting $60, you know. But it was primarily all done on Bill Acoin's American Express card.
Wow.
Yeah, which was crazy.
to think about. So the whole band's basically future and bottom line is on his credit cards to keep this ship rolling.
Before we started making money, I think we were probably in the hole about $350,000, which in the 70s was a whole lot of money. It ain't chicken feed today.
Yeah, but 1974, 40 years ago, that's probably a hole, like you said.
You know, that's why when Destroyer was out, and I did an interview, and somebody said to me, so how does it feel to be rich and famous? I said, I can tell you how it feels to be famous. You know,
and that's about it.
Yeah, get back to me. I'll let you know how it feels to be rich.
But once again, though, you're talking about, you know, and a lot of people don't understand this, the team that is so integral, even to this day, but in a different way. But the team that you guys had of, you know, Paul, Gene, Ace, and Peter, that's the band.
Mm-hmm.
But you're talking about Bill. You're talking about
Neil.
Neil Bogart.
Yeah.
You know, this is another guy who had spent a lot of money, invested a lot of money.
Look, Neil, I had issues or conflicts with Neil based upon his philosophy of how to succeed and at what cost. And it was a different way of looking at things, perhaps, than mine. You know, Neil would, you know, end your career tomorrow if you could get a hit today.
Hmm.
You know, and I was hoping for something much longer run. And quite honestly, something a lot more credible. You know, the idea of putting Kiss in Time on the first album made my skin crawl.
And that was his idea?
Totally. It was more than his idea. It was his directive, you know.
As the boss.
Yeah, you know. Right. You can only fight it so far. But the team, I mean, it was Neil who came up with the levitating drum kit. That was his idea. Hmm. You know, we had some really great people. Perhaps our point of view, philosophy differed, but it was a great team. And make no mistake, you know, it was the four guys in the band who were the engine of this thing. The engine can sometimes drive a car off a cliff, but that's what those other guys were there to do. They were there to make sure that we didn't, you know, go off the road. But it was a great team, and whatever happened over time or deteriorated or fell apart, you know, make no mistake, you know, Gene and Peter and Ace and me, that was Kiss, and that's what made it happen.
Mm-hmm.
I will never, ever take that away from us.
What about a guy like Sean Delaney? Was he involved quite a bit in those early days?
Sean was an integral part, depending upon how you choose to say it. Sean was, we were so lucky to have the people around us we did. Sean really had a vision and a point of view, and sometimes we didn't quite understand it. Most of the time he was right. When we all dyed our hair blue-black, that was Sean's idea. It was kind of like, you know, like Superman comics, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I remember being in an apartment on 11th Street, I believe, in the Village, with my head over a bathtub, and the four of us getting our hair dyed blue-black. I mean, okay, you want to dye your hair blue-black? Let's do it. So we all had this, you know, ink-black hair, which, not surprisingly, over time became very much the fashion of a lot of bands and a lot of guys in bands, you know, this Elvis inky blue black hair. And that was Sean's idea. During rehearsal one day, Sean saw us rocking back and forth just for a split second, and when the song was over, he said, you should make that part of the song, you should make that a part of what you do on stage. And I was like, choreography? Get out of here. What do you mean choreography? What are we, Paul Revere and the Raiders? You know, he was right. He was right. And that classic move from Deuce and Let Me Go Rock and Roll, that's Sean.
And you still do it to this day.
Still do it to this day.
Part of the,
it is part of what we do. And when you see other bands do it, you know immediately where it came from. So Sean was a really... He was also a co-writer. He was a road manager. He was a powerhouse. We were very, very lucky.
What kind of a road crew did you have back in those days on the first of the records?
When we first got together and built our road crew, it started with one or two people and then grew a bit. Our road crew was totally devoted to us in a way that I don't think is the norm or the what's, you know, expected with bands, particularly nowadays. These were guys who would quite literally fight and go to jail for us. These guys believed in us as much as we did.
Because they had to believe in something too, because this is so completely different from anything that's ever been seen. They have to be a part of it too.
Yeah, and they felt very much a part of it. Mm-hmm. To a point where they would confront other road crews if something wasn't done fairly, or if we didn't get enough space, or whatever. There was very little that they wouldn't do for the band. And we had JR. We had JR Smalling, and he was out with us. And when you listen to the first Kiss Alive and you hear "You Wanted the Best," that's JR.
That was his line?
And he came up with it.
He did.
Yeah, because every road manager we had, it was their job to introduce us. And each guy came up with something, and the guy before him came up with something. But those words were JR's. So JR was there. Moose was there. A guy named Peter Oroquinto. Moose was there. Of course, I'm going to get in trouble now because so my memory's failing me. It's not because I don't love these guys.
That was 40 years ago.
It was a long time ago, but...
But you had a good, once again, collection of guys that had your back and were completely incorporated in and into KISS.
Yes. And, you know, that's... You know, look, it's easy to say me, 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 and I did this. It's not usually true. It's a team. It's an army. It's... You know, wars are won by armies and games are won by teams. Very rarely is it one person. So I'm the first to say that, Mick Campisi, he was another one of the original guys. Rick Monroe was our lighting guy. Hot Sam was our sound guy. We had great truckers. I mean, you know, we started with one truck, then two. I had a security guy early on, Rick Stewart, who saved my life, literally saved my life in Hawaii. And I just spoke to him about a month ago.
How did he save your life?
I was an idiot. You know, I was on a catamaran with a bunch of other idiots who happened to be our road crew. And we decided to go out in the on a catamaran. None of us knew how to operate a catamaran. We're guys from the city.
From New York.
Yeah. You know, and I thought we were just going to stay parallel with the shore.
Right.
So that was nerve-wracking enough for me. But as we're going out, another catamaran is coming in, and the guy says to us, "Be really careful. It's taking us a while to get back in. The currents are so strong." Back then, I used to read Reader's Digest, which was a magazine that compiled articles and stories and sometimes uplifting how-to kind of articles and stories. And almost monthly, there was like, I was on a raft for 45 days, you know, or, you know, I fell overboard and existed on seagulls, you know. I mean, just, you know, these horrible stories. And being the worrywart I was back then, I'm on this catamaran. I go, I'm going to be out here like fishing for turtles in 2 months and hoping to be picked up by a freighter. So I jumped off the catamaran.
The thing you're going to swim somewhere.
Yeah, thinking, yeah, I'm going to swim in. And, of course, being from New York, I didn't even think that you have to swim diagonally. Hmm. I decided to swim straight in, which you can't do because of the current. So I'm, you know, to make a long story short, I'm in the water, As soon as I hit the water, the catamaran goes one way, I go the other way, and I look at Rick, my bodyguard, and I go, don't just stand there, jump in. So he jumps in, and the two of us are just
floating,
you know,
around,
flailing away. And I'm like, at that point, like going into like shock. And I mean, the whole thing was unbelievable. Ultimately, we got picked up by the catamaran rental. Somebody on the shore saw us with binoculars and came out and got us and dragged us into the boat. And we both had sea urchins in our feet.
Ooh.
It was not fun. But anyway, you know, here's Rick Stewart who saved my life. And in other ways, all the guys who worked for the band went far beyond what you would expect somebody on a road crew to do. These guys believed in us totally.
They were part of the revolution.
They were part of the revolution, man. And, you know, you can't win without your field operatives, and we had them.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from the people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
So when you were just done, I think it was Hotter Than Hell, the third record, or Dressed to Kill? Dressed to Kill.
Dressed to Kill.
So after Dressed to Kill comes out, once again, you're not selling what maybe you hoped to sell.
No, I believe the first album probably sold about 50,000 copies. Hotter Than Hell may have sold around 70 at that point. And I remember we were playing Santa Monica Civic. And Neil Bogart came backstage and said, the album's dead. You got to go back in the studio and do another one. So when people say, how did you do three albums in, you know, 18 months or whatever we did? Necessity. We were trying to, we wanted to make it, you know.
Yeah.
You know, we weren't waiting for inspiration. Our inspiration was to become successful. So we jumped back in the studio and did Dressed to Kill, which didn't do any better.
Mm-hmm.
And then Bill said, we're going to do a live album. And he brought in this photographer, Finn Costello, who had worked on a Uriah Heep live album. And that became the template for Kiss Alive.
As far as the photographer taking the cover picture?
Yeah, as far as packaging, you know, again, making a souvenir of an event, making something that was a take home of what you experienced. So I thought Bill was a little nuts, you know, and I remember saying to him, do you think maybe we'll sell like 250,000 copies? And he said to me, well, let's not expect too much. And that gave way quickly to 1 million, to 2 million, to 3 million, to 4 million. So it was, and once again, it resonated immediately with the fans who were waiting for something that captured this beast.
Was there any sort of urgency or like, man, if this one doesn't work, we could be in some trouble here?
Yeah, but I don't think we really understood the depth of the situation we were in. They did, Bill did, Neil did. You know, we were getting to a do or die position. They knew it more than we did because they knew how deep the well was, and they were running out of water.
Well, and Neil had basically just started Casablanca Records.
Neil started Casablanca before. With us.
With you guys.
Yes. Originally, it was going to be called Emerald City Records, and then it quickly became Casablanca and with the Bogart connection, and we were the first act signed. And by the time Kiss Alive took off, he was in arrears of, once it really took off, he was still in arrears of payments, and it was coming down to either pay or we leave.
Because he didn't have any other hits.
No, not at that point.
There's a great book, I don't know if you've read it, it's called Party Every Day, written by...
Was it Larry Harris?
Yeah, Larry Harris, who worked at Casablanca. Yeah. And talks about how Neil had spent all his money on Kiss and then spent a lot of money on this Johnny Carson.
Well, first he had this Johnny Carson debacle. You know, the idea that somebody would want an album of Johnny Carson.
Yeah, like recorded bits from The Tonight Show.
You know, it's kind of like getting an album of ballet. You know, it's, I mean, it doesn't necessarily translate that well. So he put this out and it was an absolute bomb, which, you know, put a nice hole in the ship.
Yeah.
And then we weren't taking off. And initially, Casablanca was a subsidiary of Warner Brothers and that fell apart. So, you know, it was rough going. More so for them. I mean, you know, as I said, when you're poor, you're not really fazed by anything. I mean, I'm not spending any money. I'm getting $60 a week.
Yeah. Now, if that got down to $30 a week,
then we'd be in trouble.
So let's talk about the recording of the record. I know that it was recorded over the course of a few shows.
I think it was three shows.
Three shows.
I believe it was.
Do you remember those shows?
Mm. Yeah, and I remember leading up to it because before we recorded it, we wanted to hear what we sounded like live and listen critically. And I think we recorded a show or two before and saw that we were playing incredibly fast. Mm. And it worked live, but it didn't necessarily work on record. You know, you are only using your ears. You're not seeing the band. So there was a conscious effort for us to slow down. We still played, you know, at a pretty breakneck speed, but we slowed down and recorded a few shows and then started going through them to see which version of which songs we would use and what they needed to spiff them up, spruce them up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've said before, nobody wants to hear a guitar drop on the stage. Nobody wants to hear a string break.
Mm-hmm.
If realism means listening to a wrong chord, well, then you're an idiot, because how many times are you going to want to listen to that wrong chord? So once again, we wanted to make the best live album possible.
Well,
an album that somebody would say, that's what I heard, that's what I saw.
Well, once again, too, when you're actually at a live show, if there is a guitar dropping or a clam note or whatever, you don't even really care, even if you notice it, because you're there and it's exciting.
Yeah, and rarely do you even notice it.
Right.
Because at a show, I contend you listen with your eyes and your ears.
Mm-hmm. Live record, just your ears.
Just your ears.
I don't know, have you heard the Van Halen live record that just came out?
Mm-hmm.
Very raw, probably could have used some help as far as they released it basically right off the board. That lasts forever. You can't go back and change it. So which would you rather have as a souvenir that you're going to be listening to? For me, I'd rather have an album that's had some adjustments to it, shall we say.
I would always rather hear what I remember.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it goes back to even the reunion tour. We weren't recreating the stage that people saw on our last tour. We were creating what they remembered, which is a very different thing. When we built the stage for the reunion tour, it had to live up to what people remembered the stage being, not what it actually was. Taking into account that the original band, Kiss Alive, or, you know, any of the albums afterwards, was the mid-70s, the state of the art for a show was much, much more primitive and low tech, but we pushed it to its limits. So when we came back, people remembered a show that was pushed to its limits. So we didn't go out with the idea of recreating what we had done. We went out with the idea of recreating the impression we had.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as a live recording, I want a live recording that's what I remember, not necessarily what was.
Now, when you were talking about playing a bunch of the shows and listening back, was the set list always the way that it is on a live? Was there some moving around of the songs themselves?
No, it was pretty. It was pretty much set.
So Deuce was always the opener.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and there were songs added into the set list because we didn't play that long. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we were barely a headliner, and in some places not a headliner. So did we play? I don't know how many songs are on that album.
There's probably 19. I'd say 18 or 19.
Well, trust me, we didn't play 18 or 19 songs. So we had to rotate songs out for different shows, you know, to create not only the live experience, but to put all the songs from the first three albums that we thought mattered onto an album.
Is there a little bit of a not intimidation factor, but when you're recording a live record like that, were you thinking about it?
It wasn't necessarily fun.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't fun because it was still all new to, certainly to me, and I think to all of us, and to wade into the waters of live recording. I don't want to say it took away the spontaneity, because clearly the album is quite spontaneous, but it was never out of the front of our minds during those shows.
Mm-hmm.
These are being recorded.
Right. It's got to be a little bit extra careful.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's do the best we can to need the least fix-ups and do these songs as best we can. And if there was a mistake or something happened during a song, you were much more aware of it. It was like, oh, shit,
mm-hmm.
you know, because this is being recorded. And, you know, there was a certain intimidation to that.
How tight was the band back then in 1975, 74?
In musical sense?
Yeah.
Very, very. That doesn't mean that we were musically incredibly adept, but as a band, we played as a unit. We played around whatever weaknesses there were. But well, I've seen footage from then. We were undeniable. We played with a force, much like the first time we played together as a band. There was just something created that was formidable or formidable, depending on how you choose to say it. It
integral,
was
integral.
Yeah, so very much so. We were tight. We were certainly at that point. We made no statements or professed to be virtuosos. We were virtuosos, but we played for all it was worth, and we played like a bulldozer.
See, there was a lot of maturity there for a bunch of 22-year-old kids or whatever you were, just in some of the arrangements that you did. Whether you record it later on or whatever, you're talking about the guitar solo at the end of She, where there's a little bit of a jam, the ending of Black Diamond, the whole rap during 100,000 Years is very mm-hmm. tight. When the band comes back in, I mean, it's really powerful. And that's stuff that was not on the studio albums. That was stuff that you had added live for mm-hmm. the show.
We were a street band trying to mimic or bring in the influences perhaps of musicians who were far better than we were. Mm-hmm. But that was part of the, I don't even want to say charm, because that makes it sound a little soft. That was part of what made us who we were, was that we were a more pedestrian version of some of the bands we loved.
Mm-hmm. Like a Zeppelin or mm-hmm. Beatles or whatever
sure.
it may be, right?
Sure.
Because the heaviness is there. But one thing I always noticed from Alive, and probably why it's my favorite Kiss record, at least one of my favorites, is it's heavier, it's faster. It's not over tempo,
mm-hmm.
but there's a certain energy to it, like you said, you're trying to capture that is not on those other records.
Totally.
You
because
know?
we were a live animal. We've always fed off our audience. Or fed from our audience, you know. So you can't get that except with an audience there. You know, I was saying to Evan a few weeks ago, he was going to do a gig in New York, and I said, you can train all you want in the gym, but until you get in the ring, you don't know what you have.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, you can relate to that. You know, it sooner or later comes down to putting it on the line. So, yeah, you know, for us, it was, what were we talking about?
We were just talking about how it was much more powerful and more up-tempo on the live
record. Yeah, and yeah, it goes back to, you know, you can rehearse everything, but the adrenaline and the feeding off the audience is something that is irreplaceable and is a component, certainly with Kiss. You know, the fifth member of Kiss is the audience.
Mm-hmm. Right. But you could see that on all, like, when Alive came out, and then a few years later, Budokan comes out, Cheap Trick. I think Frampton comes Alive around the same time period. All had the same thing. Like, you take Rock and Roll Night Live, Rock and Roll Night Studio, blows it away, the live version. I Want You to Want Me Live blows away the studio version. It's amazing how you guys were able to harness that and become huge stars based on the live versions of the songs that weren't really hits for the studio versions.
Yeah, and it's because, as I said, the missing member on those studio albums was the audience.
Right. How was the band tightness personally? Were you guys still all on the same page at that point in time, very early on?
We were never all on the same page, but we were excited at what we had created, and I think we were all aware that it was the differences in all of us that made part of that special chemistry. So we didn't, you know, when I say we were never friends, I don't mean that in a derogatory sense. I mean that we were very different people and had different interests and separate lives. We didn't socialize outside of being on tour. And even then it was minimal. It was, we had some fun times, but mainly being on tour was about playing and getting laid, you know, and frankly, I didn't want the other guys around for the second part of that. But we were a gang, you know. We felt a kinship. We felt special. We were Kiss. The four of us were Kiss. And regardless of our differences, there was almost, I think we found each other amusing, irritating at times. Mm-hmm. But amusing, because we were all distinct personalities, you know, and sometimes not, you know, not the most compatible. I would rather know me now than know me then. but we were on a mission, and with all our differences and all the things that made us unlike each other, we were Kiss. You know, that trumped everything.
There's some great playing on the record. I know you say your virtue no-sos and that sort of stuff, but you're talking about, you know, for example, you and Ace, some of the harmonies that you're playing, you know, even with your rhythms and his solos. How long did it take for you guys to get that locked in? Was it pretty natural, or did you have to work at it?
It was really natural. Mm-hmm. I always wanted to be in a band with two guitar players. And I can't say I don't know that Ace is of the same thought, because there are a lot of players who just want to be the guy. Mm. But I always thought that two guitars could do something magnificent, huge, you know, much larger than one guitar. So, and we just played you know, be what chord are you? What's your voicing? Show me what you're playing, and then I might go, okay. And so, it was a matter of always trying to find different voicings to make the guitar that much bigger. You know, when two guys are playing the exact same chord with the same fingering, well, it kind of cancels each other out. Mm. But when you change your voicings, you can create something huge.
Which you did. You know, also talking about, we mentioned it earlier, that the centerpiece of the record, 100,000 Years, with Peter Criss's drum solo, which is a tremendous solo, and then your rap in the middle, which, is, did you do the same thing every night? Or did that one just happen to turn out better than the others?
There was basically a format. I'm not a, you know, this idea that spontaneity will give you the best result is, I think, rolling the dice at the audience's expense. When something works, you work within the framework. So did it change? Sure, it changed, but it was within a very set framework. So the next night wouldn't have been drastically different. Today, the next night isn't drastically different. Why should it be? The people who paid to see you want to see you at your best. What, are you going to try something new? What if it sucks?
You know what's funny is our drummer, Frank, Fozzy's drummer, he can do that rap, 100,000 Years, verbatim. Completely, every little, oh yeah, woo, to where people pay him money. I bet you $10 you can't do it, and he'll stand in the middle and do it. I have to see if I can get him to do it for you. He'll
That's
be
great.
So mortified and scared.
I'd love to hear it.
But so how long was it after Alive came out that it became a hit?
Immediate. It was it was so quick. It was a combination of things. You know, by the time Kiss Alive was coming out, we were clearly seeing this groundswell happening. And Kiss Alive just pushed it over the edge. It was the proof of the greatness of the band and the connection to the fans. So very, very quickly when it came out, all of a sudden Rock and Roll All Night was on the radio. I was stunned. For one reason, it was live. Mm-hmm. You know, to have a hit on the radio that was live. I remember, you know, when I was a kid hearing Stevie Wonder do Fingertips Part 1 and 2, which was live, but there weren't that many live, you know, singles that came out. Kiss Alive, you know, gave way to Rock and Roll All Night, and Rock and Roll All Night was something people immediately took to.
What was your mindset in rearranging that song and adding the guitar solo? And it's a much more complete song live.
Yeah, I think what we were trying to do on Dress to Kill was trim away everything that wasn't necessary. And some of the songs were shorter for it, didn't have solos. Let's see what's, I don't know if anything for my baby or, you know, there were a lot of songs on there that kind of just went by quickly.
Lover All I Can is probably 2.5 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah. So in playing live, it made sense. You know, Ace was our lead guitarist. He was a lead player. And, you know, he handled that stuff great. So, of course, you know, we're that kind of band. That's what we're going to do live.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking about now millions of records are selling out the door. The crowds are growing when you're playing. You're playing bigger venues now as well.
Yeah, I mean, quickly, it just took on a momentum that was staggering. I mean, it suddenly accelerated at a crazy pace.
Did you get a raise from your $60 a week?
I think I probably made it to 65 or something. I didn't need much money then, quite honestly, because I was never home.
Mm-hmm.
We were still at a point where we were getting per diems. You know, we were getting money to cover our eating and daily expenses, which was cool because I got to pocket it, you know, because I'm going to eat at the show anyway. So, you know, I probably had $100-something a week. That was pretty damn cool. So it happened very, very quickly, overwhelmingly so.
Have you ever thought about this before? And there's an interesting theory, and it kind of makes it's food for thought. So Casablanca now starts making money. a lot of money from Kiss Alive. Mm. Then starts up their whole other arm of what made them famous, which was the disco side mm-hmm. of things with Donna Summer and Village People. Mm-hmm. In a lot of ways, Kiss Alive's success almost was able to fund the disco movement. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
I'm sorry. yeah, you know, look, was I hoping, you know, under my breath that we would leave Casablanca and go to a quote-unquote more legitimate label? Mm-hmm. Sure. I don't know if anybody would have really understood us. You know, we ultimately we did things our way. It wasn't always easy. You know, Casablanca was a big plus for us and a big cross to bear. We were thought of as one of those Casablanca acts. You know, we weren't an Atlantic act. We weren't a Columbia act. We're in Casablanca. Oh, yeah, with the guys that sing YMCA and you know.
Macho Man.
Yeah. So, but it all worked out. All worked out. You know, I'm here. I'm in this house. I'm, you know, I just came back from playing for 90,000 people, 40,000 people, you know, to generations. Quite honestly, I've been amazed. Most nights I say, how many of you have never seen us before? And it can be anywhere from 50 to 80% easily. And that's great. Mm-hmm. That's great because we are a legend and there is something connected to us which we have to go out and prove and justify to a new crowd. People have heard about us. Now we have to go out there, you know, put up or shut up. We put up pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Especially when you're playing like a download, for example, in the UK, like you said, 90,000 people. I think you were the last band of the festival on Sunday.
Yeah, I have three nights.
So they've seen literally hundreds of bands, and some of the biggest bands in rock and roll.
Yeah.
And you're the last one.
And we're going out there, not nervous at all. Mm-hmm. You know, got the kabuki, the curtain in front of us. On the other side of that kabuki is 90, 95,000 people. And I'm thinking, now you're going to find out why we're the last band here.
Hmm.
Because we've done our homework. We've done this a long time. You know, there is no substitute for experience.
A couple last things as we wrap up. And the classic back cover of Alive with the two kids holding the bed sheet with Kiss or drawn on it. Did they ever get a chance to meet you?
Yes, we've met them over the years.
Really?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. And one of them still has the sign. They're not as young as they were. Somehow I still am. You know, it's awesome. It's awesome to have a connection to people. Those guys, other people in the photo who can point themselves out. I've seen those guys over the years.
Was that Cobo Hall?
That was Cobo Hall.
Cobo Hall.
Yeah.
So Alive was recorded Cobo Hall. Mm-hmm. Do you recall the other cities?
I believe it says inside.
Okay.
I don't know if it was New Jersey or
probably in that area.
Or Indiana. I've seen those. Look, we've touched a lot of people's lives, but a lot of people have touched our lives. You know, it's a two-way street.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever I've given to people, they've given to me. You know, I mean, it's an awesome, humbling, and very thankful relationship as far as I'm concerned.
Well, now, and here we are 40 years later, and you guys are going to be doing Alive in its entirety on the Kiss Cruise, which is totally sold out. So if you don't have a ticket, you just be able to hear about it. So how do you feel about that? Have you played it in its entirety?
No, never. It was one of those head scratchers. When we do the Kiss Cruise every year, we try to do something special, figure something to set it apart. And it's the fifth year, and it just seemed like, well, yeah, I mean, We can add some nuggets and some cool extra stuff, but why don't we play the whole Kiss Alive in in sequence. It's going to be fun, you know. We're going to play it dressed the way we're supposed to be dressed. And it's going to be fun. It's going to be fun.
Are you going to try and play it pretty close to it?
Oh, like yeah.
Drum solo,
yeah.
Stage rap.
Well, you know, maybe your drummer's going to have to come up and do all the stage raps.
Have to get Frank to come up and tell you how it goes.
He'll just
hide all the behind, wild people over here.
Yeah, hide behind a curtain.
He'll do it too, man. Last question. First of all, do you ever listen to Kiss Alive?
That's a good question. No. I guess I don't have any reason to. I did it, and it's great. I don't want to say it's a baby picture, but it's a picture from a long time ago. It's a trophy that's great to look at, but a lot's happened since then.
Mm-hmm.
All good, most. And it's so long ago that I don't know what I would get out of it. I mean, Tommy and I, we did this acoustic show last week, and we did Rock Bottom, and that was awesome. You know, I mean, that just sounded, you know, the beginning of it just sounded mm-hmm. great. So I love playing those songs now. Do I necessarily want to hear them from then? No. I honestly prefer the way they sound now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I love playing with the guys. The band is terrific, and it doesn't negate the past. It's built on the past. So I'm happy to be here, thrilled to be here today. Love the band, love playing in it, and don't really feel a need to
go back to those
go
days.
Back. I mean, I was there. I lived it, you know?
Let me ask you this, and for a 22-year-old Paul Stanley being back in that, what was your favorite song to play during those days in 1975?
Gee, 1975. I mean, singing was so effortless, you know.
Yeah.
As you go on in your life, you know, you realize, like any athlete, that you lose certain things and certain things become harder, more challenging. I just reveled in singing. It was just, you know, doing 100,000 years, doing rock and roll all night. It was all great. You know, it was Strutter, Got to Choose has always been a great song for me. I've always loved that one. So, you know, I'm a big fan of our music because our music is based on the bands that I'm a big fan of,
mm-hmm.
you know? So in its own way, a lot of our songs are homages and tributes to the bands that I loved. Doesn't mean they sound like them, but they were created because of those bands.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think there's a difference between copying and being inspired by something.
Right.
So I love a lot of our songs because they're inspired by the bands I love.
All right, so one last thing. You, Dee Snider has a podcast now, and he's very vocal in the area of not liking the fact that you have somebody else playing the Spaceman and somebody else playing the Catman, even though it's been 10, 12 years. Does stuff like that bother you, or do you even care what other people think?
Well, let me put it in the simplest terms. In this case, this guy is a wannabe, has always been a wannabe, and desperately wants attention and to be taken seriously. And that will never happen because he's obviously clueless to the fact that he and his whole band are a bunch of buffoons.
So that's the response to D.
Indeed.
Indeed. Well, it's the 40-year anniversary of Kiss Alive. Black Diamond's my favorite on that record. I just love the crescendo of it and the epilogue of it and the whole thing. But excited to see you guys do it in its entirety in the Kiss Cruise.
It's going to be great. You know, the Kiss Cruise is such a phenomenon and so unique in some ways to us because of our connection to our fans. To have 3,000 plus people whose only perhaps bonding commonality is that they love Kiss is phenomenal. When you can have a doctor and you can have, you know, a guy who cleans recording studios and, you know, a family and, you know, a gay couple and, you know, onward. And the thing that binds them all together is Kiss. The fact that they're from 33 different countries and share the similarity, not lost on me. You know, it's something that's very, very emotional for me, and my sense of gratitude, never enough.
Plus, it's the only place in the world that 3,000 people will go nuts if you play Just a Boy.
Yes, thankfully.
Yeah. All right, Paul, I promise you this, too. If you fall off that cruise, I promise I'll jump in and save you.
And if I can't remember the raps, your drummer will come forward with them.
I'm going to introduce him to you. He's going to be so embarrassed. Thanks, man.
Listen, I want to tell you all, I want to tell you, you've been a dynamite audience, and you deserve to give yourselves a round of applause. Let's go. All right.
All right, thanks to Paul Stanley, the star child, 40th anniversary of the Kiss Alive album. Such a cool conversation. Paul is a great guy. And I'm really excited to hit the seas of rock and roll on the Kiss Cruise October 30th. It is sold out, so if you don't have tickets, tough luck. Maybe there's a waiting list or something, but it's going to be amazing. Kiss, Fozzy, Steel Panther, Lita Ford, Dead Daisies, Kiss doing Alive in its entirety on this cruise. And you heard the story all about Kiss Alive. Did Kiss Alive create disco? Maybe. So blame Paul Stanley. Actually, I like disco. SOS by Fozzy. Great, great tune. Great, great kind of a rockin' tune. As a matter of fact, let's play it right now. Fozzy, SOS, right here on Talk is Jericho.
Where are those happy days? They seem so hard to find. I tried to reach for you, but you have closed your mind. Whatever happened to our love? I wish I understood. It used to be so nice, it used to be so good. We'll be right back.
that's a product of the 70s, a heavier version of a 70s tune. So disco was actually a good thing. So thanks to Kiss and Paul Stanley for helping to create that amazing fad in music. Okay, great, great times in the 70s and great, great times now, 2015, as the Y2J WWE Fall Tour begins this Friday, September 11th in Edmonton, 12th Calgary, 25 Toronto, 26 Syracuse, 27 Rochester. All right, that's good times, man. October 2nd, Trenton. October 30th, the 25th anniversary of my career. I started October 3rd, 1990 in Ponoka, Alberta in the Moose Hall. October 3rd, 2015, Madison Square Garden, Jericho versus Kevin Owens. You wanted it, you got it, okay? People have seen this match around the horn on the live events. Now you get to see it in Madison Square Garden for the New York faithful. Always great Jerichoholics in New York City. Plus, it's going to be live on the WWE Network. Check that out. Jericho versus Owens. And then October 8th, 9th, and 10th, they'll be in Saudi Arabia. 16, 17, 18, returning to Mexico. All right, then Fozzy takes over. Kiss Cruise, October 30th and November 13th. We start off in Rotterdam on the Cinderblock Party Tour with Nonpoint and Sumo Psycho, okay? We're hitting all around Europe, Vienna, Hamburg, Berlin, Cologne, heading over to France, Luxembourg. Then we're going over to the UK, Reading, London, Manchester, Southampton, Birmingham, Newcastle, Nottingham, Sheffield, Wales. It's going to be a rock and roll party for sure. A rock and roll party tonight, as Paul would say. Go to FozzyRock.com for all the cities and venues and ticket information. VIP information. All right. Thank you to listening today. Thanks to Paul Stanley. And thanks to all of you Talk is Jericho supporters who download this show twice a week for free. We're able to do that thanks to the great sponsors for Talk is Jericho. Uber, DraftKings. Don't forget my promo code Y2J to play for free. SeatGeek. Use Chris Jade and get a $20 rebate on your first purchase on tickets. DollarShaveClub.com/Jericho. TrueCar, NatureBox. Use my promo code as well, Jericho, to get free snacks. So many cool things. And of course, Amazon. You buy anything you want on Amazon, do it through the Talk is Jericho link and support this show. Amazon throws a couple bucks into the kitty every time you buy something when you go to podcastone.com. Click on the support our show sponsors banner at the top of the page. Hit Talk is Jericho. It'll take you to the Amazon links for the USA, the Canada A, and the UK A. And every time you do that, Amazon kicks back a little cashola to the show. So we keep doing this for free twice a week. No extra fees or hidden charges. Just getting your shopping done, helping me out in the process. All right. Thank you so much to Paul Stanley. Man, what a rock and roll, amazing group of guests I've had. Rock icon, rock royalty, Bruce Dickinson last Friday. Paul Stanley today. And this Friday, coming up, Kerry King, new Slayer record, Repentless, is released on Friday. And Kerry is here to talk all about Repentless, all about losing Jeff Hanneman, all about Slayer. It's going to be a great, I met him, welcome to Rockville in Jacksonville. We got rained out that day, but take a negative, turn into a positive. I went and had a podcast with Kerry King. So he will be here on Friday. The list of rock and roll icons continues. I thank you for being here. We'll see you on Friday. And a big yeah, boy.
You can download new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at PodcastOne.com. That's PodcastOne.com.
Stay tuned for the latest AP news headlines from Podcast One right after this.
AP Update. I'm Tim McGuire. The people of tiny Fox Lake, Illinois, say their lives have changed since Police Lieutenant Charles Joe Glinowitz was shot and killed while pursuing three suspicious men yesterday. Debbie Lilith says everyone in the small town is on edge.
Seeing the helicopters around and not knowing and keeping our doors locked and, yeah, very scary.
Police have searched the entire village some 60 miles north of Chicago. Now they have expanded that search and the investigation. Chief George Filenko, head of the Lake County Major Crimes Task Force, says state and local police, along with federal agents, are intent on finding the three shooting suspects.
They're turning over every leaf and blade of grass to see if there's anything else out there that they may have missed.
Glinowitz, who was a 30-year veteran of the police force, was shot and killed shortly after radioing his dispatcher about the three men. AP Update, I'm Tim McGuire.